everybody. Just a few quick things before we get started today with School Sucks Podcast number 282, Self-Esteem in Schools. This is part 8 in our 6 Pillars of Self-Esteem series. First of all, I would ask you to stay tuned after the outro music. There's a couple additional clips that I cut out of the show, but I think they are worth hearing. I just put them at the end to improve the flow of the show, you know? The first one is a discussion of a section in the book where Brandon compares traits of responsible students to obedient students. And the second is Wes discussing his impressions of the book when he first read it 20 years ago. Also, tomorrow, Friday, May 2nd, we are going to be doing an extended live show from Manchester, New Hampshire. There will be additional details provided soon at our Facebook group and Facebook page. So I hope you'll tune in. I hope you'll call in. And I hope you enjoy today's show. Here it is.
Are you going to teach us anything, or are we just going to sit here?
Just do whatever you want.
I want to learn from my teacher.
Besides that, Freddie, what do you like to do?
I don't know. Burn stuff?
Just go out and have recess.
My parents don't spend $15,000 a year for recess.
What, you want to learn something?
Yes, I do.
What, you want me to teach you something? You want to learn something? All right. Here's a useful lesson for you. Give up. Just quit. Because in this life, you can't win. Yeah, you can try. But in the end, you're just going to lose big time because the world is run by the man.
Who?
The man. Oh, you don't know the man? Oh, well, he's everywhere. In the White House, down the hall, Miss Mullins. She's the man. And the man ruined the ozone. And he's burning down the Amazon, and he kidnapped Shamu and put her in a chlorine tank, okay? And there used to be a way to stick it to the man. It was called rock and roll. But guess what? Oh, no. The man ruined that, too, with a little thing called MTV! So don't waste your time trying to make anything cool or pure or awesome, because the man's just going to call you a fat, washed-up loser and crush your soul. So do yourselves a favor and just give up!
As with parents, it is easier for a teacher to inspire self-esteem in students if the teacher exemplifies and models a healthy affirmative sense of self. Indeed, some research suggests that this is the primary factor in a teacher's ability to contribute to a student's self-esteem. Teachers with low self-esteem tend to be more punitive, impatient, and authoritarian. They tend to focus on the child's weaknesses rather than strengths. They inspire fearfulness and defensiveness. They encourage dependency. Teachers with low self-esteem tend to be over-dependent on the approval of others. They tend to feel that others are the source of their self-esteem. Therefore, they are hardly in a position to teach that self-esteem must be generated primarily from within. They tend to use their own approval and disapproval to manipulate students into obedience and conformity. They teach that self-esteem comes from adult and peer approval. They convey an external approach to self-esteem rather than an internal one, thereby deepening whatever self-esteem problems students already have. Children watch teachers in part to learn appropriate adult behavior. If they see ridicule and sarcasm, often they learn to use it themselves. If they hear the language of disrespect and cruelty, it tends to show up in their own verbal responses. If, in contrast, they see benevolence and an emphasis on the positive, they may learn to integrate that into their own responses. If they witness fairness, they may absorb the attitude of fairness. If they see self-esteem, they may decide it is a value worth acquiring. What a great teacher, a great parent, a great psychotherapist, and a great coach have in common is a deep belief in the potential of the person with whom they are concerned. They possess a conviction about what that person is capable of being and doing, plus the ability to transmit that conviction during their interactions. Teachers with good self-esteem are likely to understand that if they wish to nurture the self-esteem of another, they need to relate to that person from their vision of his or her worth and value, providing an experience of acceptance and respect. They know that most of us tend to underestimate our inner resources, and they keep that knowledge central in their awareness. Most of us are capable of more than we believe. When teachers remain clear about this, others can acquire this understanding from them, almost by contagion.
Yes, Tinkerbell.
Summer, as class factotum, first I'd like to just say, welcome to Horse Green.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions about our schedule? Because usually now Miss Dunham teaches vocabulary, then gives us a pop quiz, then she'll split us up into our reading groups. Track B is reading.
Okay, hey. Miss Dumbbum ain't your teacher today? I am. And I got a headache and the runs, so I say, time for recess.
But Mr. S, that poster charts everyone's performance. We get gold stars when we master the material covered in class. How do we get gold stars if we just have recess?
What are these black dots here?
Demerits.
What kind of a sick school is this? Hmm?
So, Wes, when people see the title of today's show, Self-Esteem in the Schools, many might say, why would this need to be more than 5 minutes long, right?
Yeah, I guess it depends on the kind of self-esteem we're talking about, right?
Right. Or what else could we really say about it? Because we've spent so much time on the show in the past and in this series, you know, relating a lot of what we've talked about to the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's kind of a continuous theme on the show. So, yeah, I think this is a portion of the book that we decided was worth devoting a show to. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was thinking as I read through this, we're repeatedly sold this idea of the power of a good teacher and we chase it. You know, as professionals, I know early in my career, it was something that I was chasing. And of course, then we have the movies where people say, oh, my goodness, yeah, you think the schools are bad, but look at Jaime Escalante, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
This guy was so different from everybody else that he got a movie made about him because he was so unique and extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
So we are really sold that idea of the power of the good teacher, but it is true, too, you know? And let's not say good. I mean, let's say a teacher who's really, you know...
Inspiring?
Yeah, inspiring.
Passionate, maybe?
In tune with the needs of the kids.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Really yeah. Attending to their needs. Basically, you know, when a teacher is attentive to the students and their learning process, whether, you know, they have intrinsic motivation. And unfortunately, the school system itself is antithetical to intrinsic motivation because you're supposed to be there, right? And they're giving you assignments. You're not choosing to learn things. It's not like a Sudbury Valley school experience, right? Or unschooling experience.
Yeah, there's no negotiation.
Yeah. But nonetheless, there can be an attending to, you know, the disinterest that sometimes is exhibited, obviously, through various subjects. And maybe a more attentive teacher would pay attention to that and focus on what could make it more enriching for the students.
Yeah. And he talks about that in this part of the book as well. You know, what great teachers and parents or other kinds of coaches and mentors have in common. And as I was listening to what he had to say about it, it just reinforced the idea of how unnatural the school environment actually is.
Hmm.
He's talking about how these are people who have a deep belief in the potential you know, of the person that they're teaching or mentoring or parenting, and they have a concern for that potential and the process of reaching that potential, and they have the ability to transmit their concern to the individual. And, you know, when we're talking about the school system, that transmittal of concern is just, you know, unfortunately so non-existent. You know, I laugh because I spent 15,000 hours as a student not feeling like it was being transmitted to me, a concern. And, yeah. You know, I spent a lot of hours as a teacher, too. Looking back, not really doing a very good job myself of transmitting a concern. And, you know, now I even question how much of a concern I had. You know, students and teachers are really pitted against each other.
Yeah, it's kind of an antagonistic relationship just from the get-go, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, classroom management, behavior management seems to be the predominant orientation, trying to get everybody on the same page as we're going through the coursework, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like catering to the average, right? And not looking at individuals so much. And so, yeah, there's a lot of collectivism happening there and a lot of lost self-esteem in the process, because I never was approached with ideas of self-esteem in school. I don't know about you, but I know there was a movement later on, you know, a self-esteem movement like in California and so forth, right?
Well, this was basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, just the idea that we will grant self-esteem to children by telling them they should have it.
Because
I think if you talk to most teachers about self-esteem, they would be like, yeah, of course, this is very, very important, and we should do something to help young people develop it. So I think they embrace the idea of self-esteem, but then there's this question of, do they, by and large, understand it? Mm-hmm. Or are they just going to be stuck in the carrots and sticks model? You know, because I think he said something like what the understanding of self-esteem is in schools, because it's certainly talked about. He said it's the kind of trivial nonsense that gives self-esteem as a concept or a pursuit a bad name.
Yeah, I mean, it's really not understood in our culture very well, and in a school system especially, because if the focus were on developing authentic self-esteem in students, then the whole system would need to change, because it is, again, antithetical to really that process of self-respect and self-confidence, because you're being told what to do and when to do it, and you're going to be evaluated or graded based on that too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he has a section here. This is a really long chapter, by the way. He explores all kinds of dynamics, but in this section he says, might a student do poorly in school and yet have good self-esteem? Of course. There are any number of reasons why a particular boy or girl might not do well scholastically, from a dyslexic condition to lack of adequate challenge and stimulation. Grades are hardly a reliable indicator of a given individual's self-efficacy and self-respect. But rationally, self-esteeming students do not delude themselves that they are doing well when they are doing poorly. And then he says, we do not serve the healthy development of young people when we convey that self-esteem may be achieved by reciting, I am special, every day, or by stroking one's own face while saying, I love me, or by identifying self-worth with membership in a particular group, ethnic pride, for instance, rather than with personal character. Let us remember that self-esteem pertains to that which is open to our volitional choice. It cannot properly be a function of the family we were born into, or our race, or the color of our skin, or the achievements of our ancestors.
Yeah.
These are values people sometimes cling to in order to avoid responsibility for achieving authentic self-esteem.
So one of the pieces of that is that high self-esteem, authentic self-esteem, we should say, would really not come from this process in the schools, this forced process of inflating a warm and fluffy sense of self, as much as encouraging young people to ask questions like, what exists? To actually do the first and second pillar, to actually practice those things, you know, living consciously and accepting what is found from living consciously. That's a foundation that's necessary instead of just kind of gifting this counterfeit, poorly defined self-esteem.
Yeah, when we're not defining our terms in a non-contradictory way, then we're just kind of putting ourselves in the wrong perspective. I mean, it's like philosophizing in midstream, isn't it? Mm. You know, we have a schooling system, and now let's try to tweak it so that we can turn out so-called good citizens. You know, like he says here, the goals of education, you know, perhaps the place to begin is with how the teacher conceives the goals of education. Is the primary goal to train young people to be, quote, good citizens? Then a high premium may be placed not on fostering autonomy or encouraging independent thinking, but on memorizing a shared body of knowledge and belief, on absorbing, quote, the rules of a particular society, and often on learning obedience to authority.
Mm, yeah. Well,
that's the predominant theme, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the predominant theme. And yeah, to say it has nothing to do with an individual's self-esteem if that individual is a student is kind of an understatement.
Yeah. Like he says, I vividly recall my own experiences in grade school and high school during the 1930s and 1940s. He's in his 80s now.
Mm-hmm.
The two most important values conveyed to me in that world were the ability to remain silent and motionless for long periods of time, and the ability to march with my fellow students in a neat row from one classroom to another. School was not a place to learn independent thinking, to have one's self-assertiveness encouraged, to have one's autonomy nourished and strengthened. It was a place to learn how to fit into some nameless system created by some nameless others and called, quote, the world, or, quote, society, or, quote, the way life is. And, quote, the way life is was not to be questioned.
Yeah.
Since I questioned everything and found silence and stillness unbearable, I was quickly identified as a troublemaker.
One of the first books I read challenging the public school system in America was by John Cazole, who taught in Boston. And one of the schools that I remember him talking about was actually considered to be like the best public school in the country. It's called Boston Latin. It's also one of the oldest, too. And he said they had this mantra that they would recite the kids every day. And it was, every day, in every way, it is our duty to obey.
Ouch.
And yeah, ouch is right. You know, this was going on until maybe the 1960s, 1970s. But that's more subtle, right? It's more implied today through the entire environment and function of the school. In the past, maybe it was more explicit, and yeah, maybe that was more problematic, but that certainly still exists. That message is certainly still being sent.
Yeah, and isn't that reflective of the teacher's self-esteem as well? To what degree does one comply with that whole process? You know, he says here, teachers tend to use their own approval and disapproval to manipulate students into obedience and conformity, since that is the approach that works when others apply it to them. You know, administrators, right?
That, yeah, and I'll tell you, I can actually really identify with that, being over-dependent on the approval from others, because it seems like everything hinges on that. Now, I don't know how that was my experience, and I taught in a private institution, and I had things said to me, you know, along with a whole group of teachers, in the middle of one of our grievances, the executive director of the school that I worked at said, I could have you all replaced on Monday, right? Now, you can't say that, though, to a room full of unionized teachers, but the union itself, I think it really shows that it's often composed of individuals who are lacking genuine self-esteem. Because it's forget about approval and disapproval at that point. We're going to basically use force to get what we want, to get what we've decided that we deserve. But even without all the politics of school, when it comes down to the actual ins and outs of the classroom or the school environment, I think approval is important. And I think if a lot of teachers were like me when I was a young, you know, mid-20s, working in a challenging school, you want the people that you're surrounded by every day, even if they are teenagers, to approve of you too. You know, you don't want to feel that they are sending you this consumer feedback that you suck, you know, or that you're not interesting or that you're not worthy of respect. But that's how it feels a lot of the time for teachers.
Yeah. And of course, as Brennan notes, that low self-esteem is highly correlated with unhappiness. So low self-esteem teachers are typically unhappy teachers, and unhappy teachers often favor demeaning and destructive tactics of classroom control.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's another problem that goes right along with that. back to the idea of kids, students and teachers being pitted against each other, right? So there's a line in the book where he says that we, even ourselves, we tend to underestimate our inner resources, you know? Well, teachers certainly underestimate the inner resources of students, because even if it's not explicit, like even if there isn't a meeting at the end of the day with teachers and administrators where the principal says, okay, now you remember when you come in tomorrow, the kids are your enemy, but it feels that way sometimes. So obviously it's not a nurturing environment, because that's necessary, you know, that teachers need to relate to these young people and understand and try to, he has this expression that he used, gold mining, right? That those those inner resources are there, and maybe things are worse at home, or maybe things are bad socially for the kid, and those inner resources are being overlooked, or maybe they're not doing well in another part of school. Maybe they hate math, maybe they hate English, and this history class is an opportunity to really bring some of that stuff out. But because of the system pitting these two interest groups against each other, a lot of teachers are overlooking that or never really realizing the opportunity to mine for gold as far as those inner resources are concerned.
Yeah, he has an interesting quote by this guy, Robert Reasoner, who published a book called Building Self-Esteem, A Comprehensive Program for Schools, back in 1992. And he wrote, teachers with high self-esteem are more apt to help children develop problem-solving strategies than to give advice or deny the significance of what children perceive to be problems. Such teachers build a sense of trust in students. They base their classroom control on understanding, joint cooperation, and involvement, working through problems, caring, and mutual respect. Now, it's just interesting that in the same sentence, classroom control and mutual respect are both used. You know, it's really dropping the context, course of context, isn't it?
Yeah.
This positive relationship allows children to learn and to grow in their confidence and ability to function independently. So that's interesting, to keep you in control, in a controlled environment, to function independently. It's really sad that this premise of classroom control or teacher control of students is accepted as the given, and then we start trying to figure out how kids are going to be able to get self-esteem in that context, rather than checking our premises, right? And re-strategizing a way to have win-win relationships with learners, essentially. But that was the quote by Reasoner. Here's what Brandon wrote. What a great teacher, a great parent, a great psychotherapist, and a great coach have in common is a deep belief in the potential of the person with whom they are concerned.
Yeah.
A conviction about what that person is capable of being and doing, plus the ability to transmit the conviction during their interactions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So like this example, quote, I always did poorly in math in school, client said to me, and I always knew I could never do well until I met a teacher who refused to believe me.
Yeah.
She knew I could do math, and her certainty had so much power, it was irresistible, unquote. The ability to inspire students in this way is not usually found among teachers who have little belief in themselves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot to be said for that, you know, even outside of the context of school. Just an unrelenting belief in a person can inspire them to believe in themselves at some point.
Absolutely. So let's make it personal for a minute. I remember the first experience that I had with somebody like this. I was like a sophomore in college, you know, and it wasn't like along the way for the first K through 12, 13, 14 years of school, I never encountered anyone who was likable or caring. There were probably quite a few people like that along the way. I mean, I can remember two or three. And that was such a transformative experience for me. I was 19. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I didn't care about anything. I didn't think I was smart. And it was this person kind of refusing to let me be lazy. Or to give up, or to be mediocre, or to just kind of get by. That really changed a lot of things for me and led to me embracing that subject and then recognizing that I could be successful with some very difficult material. And it really slowly started to transform my whole attitude about, you know, not just my own abilities, but where my life was going. And it was right around that time that I had another experience doing an internship that just sent me in a completely different direction from where I was going, which really was no place good or interesting. And that, you know, I owe that teacher. His name was Todd Breida. Last I knew, he was teaching at a community college in Connecticut somewhere. I owe him a lot, you know. Did you have anyone like that in K through 12 or college that really stands out for you?
Well, I guess not really in terms of psychological inspiration so much as maybe intellectual or scholarship, I guess, focus. I had two teachers in high school, the Gamaches, Tony and Tom. One taught all the math subjects, including trigonometry and advanced math and so forth, and then calculus as well. And then Tom taught Latin and English grammar and literature and so forth. So these two guys wore suits to this little school in the middle of nowhere, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
They had that sort of dedication to the learning process, and they used humor quite a bit in the process. And I thought that was really, I liked their authentic dedication to the learning process and esteeming the abilities of people to learn. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, humor is very powerful. It's a great tool for bringing new ideas and new information to people. And those were the teachers that I found to be the best and the most impactful, the ones who could do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember some things that they would say sometimes that were pretty funny. Like, if you guys ever want the number to that 1-800 truck driving school, I have it.
Right. Yeah.
That was kind of the contrast. You know, if you didn't excel in these subjects, then you're going to be a truck driver, which is kind of a sad commentary as well, because we don't want to demean any sort of productive work in the culture. And
absolutely. I've never driven. Yeah, not that one. We'd all be dead.
Yeah, exactly. But they were always trying to focus on what could actualize our potential more. And various quotes by Shakespeare we memorized, including the one from Macbeth, you know, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Yeah.
Creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools their way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life is but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
How about that?
Now, that is probably the most, you know, depressing Shakespearean quote imaginable, isn't it?
But it's in your memory forever.
Yeah, exactly. But that tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow quote, it reminds me of that movie, right? Where the one boy commits suicide. It's an older flick, so I'm not going to spoil it for anybody. I'm sure they've seen it. With Robin Williams, he's the teacher, you know, Oh Captain, My Captain.
Mm-hmm. Wait, what movie is this? It's
Dead Poets Society.
Dead Poets Society, yep.
Exactly. Great flick. Very moving film. And it just, you know, it shows the psychological issues that are going on in adolescence, and especially family issues. You know, that the one boy that had so much inner conflict. I haven't seen the movie in many, many years, but I just remember he had quite an overbearing father, I think it was, and was demanding things of him and expecting things of him, and he had to excel and had to be this scholar. And, you know, there's so much of that kind of pressure, especially in prep schools, you know, to get into the Ivy League schools, and just this competitive atmosphere that is not conducive to self-esteem, because you're comparing yourself to other people and you're being judged by other people, and you're not practicing self-acceptance, essentially, that foundation of self-esteem that we all require in order to live well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I like what he, you know, Brandon wrote in this class environment section, a child's dignity. One of the painful things about being a child is that one tends not to be taken seriously by adults. Whether one is dismissed discourteously or praised for being, quote, cute, most children are not used to having their dignity as human beings respected. So a teacher who treats all students with courtesy and respect sends a signal to the class. You are now in an environment where different rules apply than those you may have been used to. In this world, your dignity and feelings matter. In a simple way, a teacher can begin to create an environment that supports self-esteem.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to talk about the gifted children, you know, these labels that we use. And of course, all the categorization and the grading and achievement tests. I mean, it's a psychological, intellectual pressure cooker And if the self-esteem principles are not made explicit and focused on, then obviously we get all the things that we see, you know, all of the psychological ailments, destructive behaviors, you know, suicide attempts and suicide, you know, achievements, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dark, dark place when we don't focus on these basic principles by which our minds function well and our feelings are in tune with that, you know?
Absolutely. And because the school is such a power over system, there's really this destructive leverage. There are a lot of teachers there who are really not in touch, not in tune with the needs of the students they quote unquote serve. Mm-hmm. But that destructive leverage is significant. When you think about how severe the impact of one bad teacher, for lack of a better word, can be as far as extinguishing the fire, as Brandon says in the book. And
mm-hmm.
it goes back again to the adversarial relationship between students and teachers that we talked about. But it's just that kind of power over system allows even a few bad apples to really wreak havoc. When you think about the impact that has on children, it's really tragic. Because I think there are people who are attracted to that profession because they have low self-esteem and because they want that environment where they can be an authority and have power over people.
Yeah, that's the real tragedy, because they're in a system then and they're abiding by their role, right, as a teacher to have that power over, to be in charge. And that is inherently disconnecting from that authentic self.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When we're playing these roles, we're not being real people. And that's so tragic psychologically for the teacher, obviously, but as well, you know, the students themselves aren't seeing a model of authenticity.
No, yeah.
And when you spend years of your life in essentially an airless government bunker, not seeing examples of authenticity, it wears on one's soul.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word. It is debilitating in many ways, and it's no wonder that people can get cynical and sarcastic and dismissive and just kind of nihilistic about the world and so forth, and the way the adult world especially functions. It you know, the movies, The Breakfast Club, on from there, that show how difficult this system is for people that are wanting clarity and wanting understanding and want empathy, essentially. There's not much empathy that goes on. Under the section on attention, it's interesting because I can see that there's theorists out there and practitioners like Chaim Gnat, the psychotherapist, wrote a book called Teacher and Child. Tom Gordon, you know, Teacher Effectiveness Training.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of falling from Rogers, just like Marshall Rosenberg, trying to outline what would be a better way for people to interact in this system. Like, they're almost accepting the system as the given, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And they're trying to make it as humanistic as humanly possible. You know?
Yeah.
So Jane Bluestein writes, he has a quote here, "When we ask our students to do something, we usually have a better reason than because I said so. Telling them the real logical intrinsic reason for a limit or a rule, so the markers do not dry out, for instance, so that we do not disturb anyone on our way down the hall, or so that no one trips and falls, builds commitment and cooperation even from rebellious students."
Yeah, it's this question of, are the rules imposed or explained? Most of what we're talking about is these adults who might even want to make these connections. They're being robbed of the opportunities to make those connections because of the environment. So the question becomes, how can I make students do blank? Versus how could I inspire students to want to blank, you know,
yeah,
which
here's
is
the
more in tune with self-esteem too, with self-responsibility and self-efficacy, to give them that control. But it's all about imposing rules, and you know, places need rules. I'm not against rules per se,
mm-hmm.
but when you're trying to help especially young people, you want them to buy into and understand what contributes to success and happiness.
Contributing to other people's well-being and one's own, mm-hmm. like the win-win process that nonviolent communication advocates, where we want to, you know, be in a place of compassionate giving. And that kind of renders the rules superfluous or irrelevant in a sense, because when we're in that place of compassionate giving, we're just naturally guiding ourselves in a way that's going to be helpful for others as well as ourselves. So it's almost like rules are these external impositions, oftentimes within systems of coercion, such as schools, that don't trust people to be able to cultivate that compassionate giving space. You know, like it said here, Brandon wrote, a teacher can think about rules in one of two ways. She or he can wonder, how can I make students do what needs to be done?
Yeah.
Or how can I inspire students to want to do what needs to be done? The first orientation is necessarily adversarial and at best achieves obedience while encouraging dependency. The second orientation is benevolent and achieves cooperation while encouraging self-responsibility. The first approach threatens pain. The second offers values and power too. I guess empowerment. Which approach a teacher feels more comfortable with has a good deal to do with his or her sense of efficacy as a person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes a teacher may feel that there is no choice but to motivate by a student's desire to avoid a negative rather than to gain a positive. So there we get the carrots and sticks thing, right?
Yeah.
Perhaps so, but as an exclusive or dominant policy, it is psychologically disempowering. It makes escape from pain more important than experiencing joy, which leads to self-contraction, the contraction of thought and feeling, rather than self-expression and self-development. So in teacher effectiveness training, Gordon also has a parent effectiveness training, he proposes that students participate in the process of rule setting, that they be invited to think through what an effective classroom requires. So they're active participants in this whole process, right?
Yep.
And this has the advantage not only of stimulating superior cooperation, but also of fostering greater autonomy.
Exactly. And I unfortunately know of only one school that's ever tried something like that.
Yeah, Sudbury?
Yep. And we saw Sudbury, you know, firsthand. You actually participated in one of those discussions.
Yep, I remember that.
And there was things about it that I really liked. And also there's a strong message of collectivism there as well. And it's tough, right? It's mm-hmm. it's tough to balance that because obviously community is important and respecting the needs of other individuals is important. But remembering that the individual is important too, that seemed to be kind of falling by the wayside at Sudbury.
Yeah, the whole democracy thing with the flag and the Constitution. Daniel Greenberg, the founder of the school, just didn't really ferret out the contradictions and that stuff. So he's kind of enculturating the students to kind of fit into this society of contradictions, you know, of political contradictions that are just enormous and debilitating. And so that's counter, obviously, to nurturing autonomy and respecting individuals in the Sudbury School, right? That it's almost like, I think we've talked about this before, but anarchy is great for kids, unschooling and stuff, but when you become an adult, yeah, not so much. You got to pay your taxes, you got to be a good citizen, you got to abide by regulations, and make sure you vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, what the hell happened? We've regressed back before childhood, I guess, or something that is just not enriching for anybody as adults. Like, adults in our society are treated worse than children in many respects because they're actually adults. They're mature human beings biologically, but they're being treated in a way that they can't get their needs for autonomy and choice and respect, fairness, you know, go down the list, independence, when they're told what to do and when to do it. Otherwise, they get punished, even killed by a cop
mm-hmm.
enforcing some law. And where'd the law come from? Well, some attorneys wrote it down. They passed it in some thing called the legislature, right? And the incentives are so perverse in that context. There's no respect for individuals. There's no understanding of property rights. You know, the basic understanding of jurisdiction is out the window with the governmental system. So it's really treating people as if they can't achieve self-esteem, as they can't be trusted. Obviously, you can't be trusted with your money, your own resources. That's why we have taxation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we didn't have taxation, nobody would pay for anything, apparently.
Yeah. One more comment on Sudbury, too, is the problem with what I observed is it was kind of giving kids this fantasy of what society could be, right?
Ah, yeah.
So a lot of them, I talked to Gardner Goldsmith about it, and I mentioned him because he, you know, grew up in this area. You know, he's lived around here for 40 years. And he's obviously, he knows a lot about politics and left versus right. And Sudbury is in Massachusetts, or the original Sudbury is in Massachusetts. And he said, yeah, the school just has a reputation of churning out like hardcore left winger types. But that makes sense because they're playing out this fantasy of this ideal society that unfortunately it seems like a lot of people believe exists out there in the world where there can be fairness because everyone has a voice, and that voice actually says something in a political context. So those were my...
We must believe. We have to believe. It must be true, Brett.
Yeah.
It must be true.
Yes.
There's no place like home.
Exactly.
There's no place like home.
Yes.
Yeah. Home of the free, land of the brave, right?
Yes.
Or land of the free, home of the brave, whichever it is. We don't get any of it because the system is power over. It uses coercion as basic premise by which to get people to do things. You know, threats, punishments, jail cells, fines. I mean, all these things are just... more manifestations of the carrots and sticks. And what better way to get people aligned with that perspective than to put them in these schools where their autonomy is stripped from them and they're told what to do and when to do it. And maybe they're given some inspiration by some teacher, you know, to maybe have them really reflect on what their life means in a better fashion so that they rid their lives of thinking about suicide, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. or even attempting it. You know, and really looking at life as an unlimited horizon, you know, with all kinds of possibilities, and that change is a natural thing for us, that we can improve ourselves constantly, and you know, that's the best we can hope for within that system, obviously, that is inherently power over. But I like this quote by Haim Gnat. You know, the essence of discipline, he writes in Teacher and Child, is finding effective alternatives to punishment. Now, I like part of that quote, I guess, because it speaks to the fact that punishment is ineffective, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it is contrary to intrinsic motivation. Like Rosenberg asks, you know, whenever you are thinking about punishing a child, ask yourself these two questions. What do you want the child to do? And what do you want their reasons to be for doing it?
Yeah.
And that second question is the real kicker, because it's like, oh, yeah, I don't really want them to do it because they're afraid of me, or they're afraid of getting punished. Or they're, you know, they're just subjected to power over. I want them to be in that place of compassionate giving, right? Well, how do they ever get to that place if they're subjected to punishment, you know, threats and so forth? And Brennan wrote, his chapter on discipline in this book is outstanding in the strategies he offers for motivating students in ways that enhance rather than diminish self-esteem. So I think, again, Gnat is also taking the present context as the given. Although he's really kind of pushing the envelope as to how you interact with little people in respectful ways while still keeping the systems intact in some way, rather than just being an abolitionist. We need to get rid of these power over systems because they're not really helping anyone. In the short term, maybe they're helping some people, perhaps, but in delimited ways and not nearly as much as can be helped when learners, any individual, when their needs for autonomy and choice and respect are met.
Those systems also have a buildup too, you know, because there's so many of them and it's such an accepted mm-hmm. way of thinking. And
their own inertia and momentum, yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that I constantly overlooked when I was a teacher was the amount of distress that kids were already bringing to school with them. Forget what might have been created by the school experience itself, right? So the distress of home, you know, troubled families, the distress that was generated from the fact that a lot of them already had run-ins with another domination system called criminal justice.
Yeah.
You know, most of their problems that they had that led to some kind of legal repercussion were truancy or pot smoking, you know, but that mm-hmm. put them in the system. And I remember having these really difficult conversations where, you know, I mean, I didn't think the way I do today, but I didn't feel right about saying, well, look, you know, you got to play by the rules. And I would acknowledge that, yeah, what you're dealing with sucks. And in many ways, it might be unfair, but don't create more problems for yourself. You know, if you want to smoke pot or you want to do this and that, wait till you're out of this system, because here you have no power. And that was a hard thing to say and a hard thing for them to hear. And you know, I was trying to be sympathetic as well, but also acknowledging what is, like, you have no power here. You can only make more trouble for yourself here because you have all of these different systems already coming down on you. The school's coming down on you. The law is coming down on you. Your parents are coming down on you, or there's some other kind of, you know, significant dysfunction in the home. It was some of these kids were in a really, really tough spot, but most of the time, because of even a private school environment, doing what I already spoke about, you know, pitting students and teachers against each other, and also teachers like myself seeing student success or student engagement as a measure of my own worth or skill or knowledge, there was really no time for me to really find ways to be in tune with the distress that lots of them felt for lots of different reasons a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing to look back on, but it happened.
Yeah, and I think one of the basic needs that goes unmet in that context, that milieu, is visibility.
Yeah.
To be seen and heard for who one really is. You know, and it speaks back to that talk of believing in the person that's learning things. Like, to have that sense that you're going to achieve profound things and you have this capability. I see it in you. You know, to have that sense of visibility of that, of your own potential, is a powerful thing.
One of the most effective lines, and, you know, in that it worked in a pragmatic sense, and it was also one of the things that, in retrospect, I think it, the feeling it produced was something that was very genuine. Even before what I was just talking about, and he has a story like this in the book too, I would say, can you help me? You know, can you help me do this? And it goes back to recognizing that kids do have these abilities and they do have this understanding. And instead, when a problem occurs, instead of saying, you will do this, you know, I don't want to inspire you to want something. I want to make you do something. Mm-hmm. But to say, can you help me solve this problem, was really something that I think at the time might have felt like desperation on my part, but it was actually genuine, right? Like, we were in an environment working together, everybody trying to get all these needs met. Everybody needed each other's help. Mm-hmm. You know, the recognition that, yeah, I might not be as much of an authority here. Like, when we put everything on the scale and weigh it, I might not be as much of an authority here as a lot of people think I am, or that I'm supposed to be, or that you might be resentful of me for trying to be. Like, that's not mm-hmm. really real, you know? Like, I'm a person with challenges, and there's a lot of things about this environment that are making me kind of uncomfortable too.
Yeah, it speaks to the arbitrary nature of the system that people are abiding by. And yeah, how to make the best of a bad situation is kind of the theme in this chapter, talking about the problems that can arise, like in this section, to achieve the results they want. And this is after he's talked about, you know, low self-esteem can impel some teachers to be rigid and punitive, even sadistic, and it can impel others to be kind of mushy, you know, with a permissiveness, you know, that signals a complete absence of authority, right? Mm-hmm. And then he has a dash with classroom anarchy as the result, right? Anarchy in the classroom. So that's the fear that I think is deeply embedded in this sort of parental adult role in relation to children. And it's terribly unfortunate, because it speaks to one's own experiences as a child and how one didn't get one's need for trust met. Mm-hmm. That's a big one. So in this instance, to achieve the results they want, teachers sometimes have to exercise imagination. Problems cannot be reduced to a list of formula strategies that will fit every occasion. One teacher I know solved the classroom problem by gravely asking the biggest, noisiest boy in the class, when they were alone, if he could help her.
Yep.
By exercising his natural leadership abilities to persuade some of the others to be more orderly. The boy looked a bit disoriented, evidently not knowing how to answer, but peacefulness quickly prevailed, and the boy responsible felt proud of himself.
Yep. Another one was, I need, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is mm-hmm. not... Yeah, and saying to, this was really in preparation, and I've given this advice to parents, to say, you know, preparation, planning ahead, is a great way to minimize problems that might occur if they're anticipated and talked about, you know? I just had this conversation with my mother, who was kind of frustrated with her two grandchildren. You know, because mm-hmm. she takes them to the park and they kind of shit talk each other. You know, she's like a 64-year-old woman, and she's got to chase these two, they're like 5 and 4, and they're mm-hmm. They're boys, and they get into it with each other. They get excited. So we were talking about this, and It was a few weeks ago. I said to her, you know, well, try this. And she did. And it worked, she said, to some extent, you know, because I saw her a couple weekends in a row. The first one we had this conversation, I said, well, you know, prepare them for what you expect, what you need to happen. How can they help you, so to speak? And the next time she did it and she had better results. So I was really happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Because it was weird, you know, like when I was growing up, I couldn't give her parenting advice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was
exactly.
when I was five,
uh-huh.
you know, I couldn't say, Mom, you know what you should really be doing here? Because I had no idea. You know, those
yeah.
people were larger than life to me then. But now we're just two adults and, you know, she brought up a problem and I felt like I had some ideas as far as a solution was concerned. So it was uh-huh. a good conversation.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, understanding emotions is really vital here. He has a section. I think this is one of the more really vital aspects of the chapter because it speaks to the parenting stuff that we talked about last time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because oftentimes the parenting strategies are very, very similar to the schooling strategies. It's just kind of like a smooth transition, if you will, from one power over system to another. And he wrote, if a proper education has to include an understanding of thinking, it also has to include an understanding of feelings. And it reminds me of Marshall Rosenberg saying, you know, he went to school for all these years and no one ever asked him what he was feeling. You know, how tragic is that?
Mm-hmm.
Where emotions are roughly half of our consciousness experience and they're really denigrated. They're neglected, essentially.
Yeah.
The behaviors are dealt with, attended to, and disciplined and all that, but the emotions underlying strategies, not so much focused on. And he said, unfortunately, many parents implicitly teach children to repress their feelings and emotions, or those which parents find disturbing. Stop crying or I'll really give you something to cry about. Don't you dare get angry. Don't be afraid. Do you want people to think you're a sissy? No decent girl has such feelings. Don't be so excited. What's the matter with you? It's so tragic. Emotionally remote and inhibited parents tend to produce emotionally remote and inhibited children. This is accomplished not only through their overt communications, but also by their own behavior, which signals to a child what is, quote, proper, quote, appropriate, and, quote, socially acceptable. Further, parents who accept certain teachings of religion are likely to convey the unfortunate notion that there are such things as, quote, evil thoughts or, quote, evil emotions. It's a sin to feel that. The child may learn moral terror of his or her inner life.
Yeah. So the takeaway is that your inner world doesn't matter. Your inner world is an inconvenience, or your inner world just pales in comparison as far as importance is concerned to,
yeah.
you know, this whole picture, this whole thing that we have to participate in, or what my needs are as the parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
or the inner world is just annoying. You know, your inner world annoys me, so I'm going to help you suppress it or repress it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess when it gets to that point, irritation, annoyance, you know, feelings are come up. It, you know, there's been a long chain of abuses, right? A long chain of neglect of emotions. So then children tragically act out what they're needing, what needs haven't gotten met. How are they expressing that, you know? And I guess, you know, if the parent doesn't have an understanding and the teacher doesn't have an understanding of what emotions are, then it can be really, really difficult, obviously. He wrote here, an emotion is both a mental and physical event. It is an automatic psychological response involving both mental and physiological features to our subconscious appraisal of what we perceive as beneficial or harmful to oneself. Emotions reflect the perceiver's value response to different aspects of reality, for or against me. Good for me or harmful, to be pursued or to be avoided, and so forth. So the discussion of the psychology of emotions may be found in the disowned self. And he wrote that book, by the way, kind of addressing this penchant for repression that is kind of a theme in Ayn Rand's novels. Like the heroes that are portrayed in those books tend to not be so emotional.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Like the way Ayn Rand portrayed them. So it can kind of encourage, you know, this perspective of being heroic at the expense of your emotions, like not paying attention to what's going on internally. For example, all the unprocessed trauma from childhood and school, that needs to be processed, needs to be reflected upon and really integrated in a mature way now that we have more abilities to cope, less need for defenses, you know, to protect ourselves as children, you know, so we can work through all those things and become more of who we really are, that authentic person that really wants to do kind things for ourselves and to get in that place of compassionate giving with others as well.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what I like about Brandon's sentence completion exercises, because they speak to that voice, you know,
yes,
the sage self, and helps us realize more of ourselves, the best within us, you know, that can do all the things we think we can't do and knows all the things we think we don't know. We can trick ourselves into, you know, putting ourselves down. Mm. And that quote by Brandon, you know, self-concept is destiny. I think that is pretty succinct, isn't it?
Yeah.
So how do we orient ourselves to enrich our lives and to believe in ourselves, to trust in our own functioning amidst all of these impositions in the culture, and especially in schools that are judging us as right or wrong, good or bad, you know, good enough, you know, all these kinds of questions about our own efficacy and worth are brought up. And, you know, it's one thing to have this particularized efficacy or self-efficacy, you know, like Albert Bandura coined that term, you know, to do tasks that are specialized and to have confidence in that. But what about just the everyday functioning of our consciousness? Do we really trust our mind to make decisions and to guide us? Like, if we don't, then we're kind of setting ourselves up for a whole bunch of trouble and conflict, right?
Sure. And it's not something that, you know, you do or you don't. It's,
yeah,
you identify the components that contribute to success and you practice them, you know, and you're mindful of them and you're
exactly, yeah. Because we can't just tell ourselves, we can't will ourselves into self-esteem. We can orient ourselves to the practices, like you say, see it as this process of becoming more and more aware of our inner world, which speaks to knowing more and more about our emotions, you know?
Yeah.
Like he says here, to cease to know what we feel is to cease to experience what things mean to us. This unconsciousness is often actively encouraged in children. A child may be led to believe that emotions are potentially dangerous, that sometimes it is necessary to deny them, to make oneself unaware of them. The child can learn to disown certain emotions and cease to experience them consciously. On the psychological level, a child deflects awareness, thereby ceasing to recognize or acknowledge certain feelings. On the physical level, a child inhibits breathing, tenses his or her body, induces muscular tensions, and blocks the free flow of feelings, thereby inducing a partial state of numbness. I do not wish to imply that parents are the only source of childhood repression. They are not. Children can learn on their own to protect their equilibrium by disowning certain of their feelings, as I discuss in Honoring the Self. It's a great book, by the way. However, it is undeniable that too many parents encourage the practice of emotional repression by making it a tacit condition of their approval. As the child grows, he or she may slash away more and more feelings, more and more parts of self, in order to be accepted, loved, and not abandoned. The child may practice self-repudiation as a survival strategy. He or she cannot be expected to understand the unfortunate long-range consequences. So a teacher is in a position to teach children a rational respect for feelings, coupled with an awareness that one can accept a feeling without having to be ruled by it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Pause. Think about that.
Yeah, we can learn to own when we are afraid and accept it. And, for instance, still go to the dentist when it is necessary to do so. We can learn to admit when we are angry and talk about it and not resort to fists. We can learn to recognize when we hurt and own the feeling and not put on a phony act of indifference. We can learn to witness our feelings of impatience and excitement and breathe into them, and yet not go out to play until we have finished our homework. Uh-oh, so there we are in this system dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's imposed the homework? Is this self-induced or is this other-induced? That makes all the difference, doesn't it, in terms of intrinsic motivation?
Yeah, I don't think self-induced would be called homework, right?
Yeah. We can learn to recognize our sexual feelings and accept them and not be controlled by them in self-destructive ways. We can learn to recognize and accept our emotions without losing our minds. We can learn to wonder, what might my feelings be trying to tell me? What might I need to consider or think about? We can learn that a pain or fear confronted is far less dangerous than a pain or fear denied. We can learn that we are accountable for what we choose to do, but that feelings as such are neither moral nor immoral, they simply are. Today, this is the kind of understanding that some people gain only in psychotherapy. But in the schools of the future, no one will finish the 12th grade, and here he's again in the current system, right, where we have grades, without having been exposed to these ideas. They will be an integral part of everyone's education because of their clear importance to the achievement of a decent life. So, obviously, we're not a fan of the grades, marching people through classes in lockstep at the same age group. This is so unnatural, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It had a military origin, actually, in Germany, the gymnasium schools. That's where that actually came from.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I am opposed to the grades, for sure.
Yeah, no self-respecting school would do that. Like, children need to learn. That's one of the valuable skills, is to learn how to assess one's own level or ability so you can set new goals that are achievable and not unattainable, you know? It's like, you don't want to develop learned helplessness. And I think the externally imposed things in this learning process can really hinder or damage, you know, create learned helplessness so that one doesn't actually pursue what one really wants to pursue. You know, out of fear of failing, fear of not being good enough.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, grading is a way to sort of trigger more of that fear, you know, because it's out of your control. Someone else is going to be assessing you. So now you're out of yourself. You're not grounded in that authenticity. And in a sense, you're encouraged to repress the fear, too. You're supposed to just buck up and cram for the exam.
Oh, it's just so commonplace. You know, the stress and the frustration that causes people, it's like a joke. You know, when you think
if it weren't so tragic, it would be a joke, yeah.
Yeah. People talk about it like it's a joke. And you think about putting an adult through a process like that, you know, against their will, with so much riding on this thing that I'm making you do.
You know, Brandon mentions that grading needs to be objective, have an objective criteria. And I think he's just accepting that premise that teachers are going to be the graders in a future society rather than each individual. And, you know, you can decide, hey, I want to take a test, see how I do on this. You know, that is all part of the intrinsic motivation process. But to have external authorities looming over you, making sure that you're doing everything according to the plan, is not helpful for self-esteem, right?
Yeah.
And it assumes that you can't be trusted with learning that process. But that's the most important thing to learn, like setting goals for oneself and to assess one's own abilities so that one knows that one can succeed in whatever one does.
Yeah.
And even if one fails, it's okay because the next goal can be set and achieved.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking, as we're recognizing some of these places where Brandon is getting stuck, right? Some of the language that he's using.
Yep.
It occurred to me that this was a book that was written when? In 1993, 1994?
Yeah, 94.
Well, you know, the entire world, and certainly for adolescents, it's changed since then. You know, kids were invisible. I was 17 in 1994. I had no voice. I had no outlet for so many things compared to today. Anyway, I had no YouTube to post to. I had no way to connect with people or share my ideas. So I think even as in touch as Brandon was with, you know, the needs of young people in the writing of this part of the book, all those rules are ready to be thrown away as soon as people are ready to throw them away. I mean, he was just writing from a different vantage point in history, right? And now we can look back at the last 20 years and we can see what has become possible. And we can see the silliness of these old rules and old strictures and old routines of school in a way that maybe he couldn't at the time, in a way that hardly anyone could at the time, except for people who were on the cutting edge of school reform or school rebellion.
Yeah, one last quote. I think it's probably good to end on, perhaps. Mm-hmm. The obedient student was taught not to challenge authority. The responsible student is prepared to question, and if need be, to challenge anything.
Yes.
Which includes the schooling system itself, right?
I like that.
Yeah. Being response able, which entails all the other pillars, living consciously, accepting the situation, the facts, asserting oneself, having integrity, you know, adherence to one's values, being congruent with what one believes, and having that purpose, that initiative within oneself to rely on self to achieve things.
Try to think back to what it would have been like to be in a class where the teacher felt there was no more urgent task than to discover the good in you, your strengths and virtues, and to help you become more aware of them. Would that have inspired the best in you? Would that be an environment in which you were motivated to grow and learn?
And if I was going to give you a grade, I would give you an A. But that's the problem. Rock ain't about doing things perfect. Who can tell me what it's really about? Frankie.
Scoring chicks?
No. See? No. Eleni?
Getting wasted.
No. Come on. No. Leonard.
Sticking it to the man?
Yes. But you can't just say it, man. You gotta feel it in your blood and guts. If you wanna rock, you gotta break the rules.
He has a couple columns here kind of comparing and contrasting the obedient student versus the responsible student, which I thought was pretty interesting. There's a list of 19 different things here. Any of those catch your eye?
I only have
sitting there with the book. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we could focus on the positive. The responsible student characterized by the following traits: motivated by internal factors, such as the need to weigh choices and experience personal consequences, makes choices as opposed to follows orders, right?
Mm-hmm.
More confident to function effectively in the absence of authority, takes initiative, as opposed to lacking confidence to function effectively in the absence of authority, or and waits for orders. That's a common thing, isn't it?
When we're
in an atmosphere of obedience. What's going to be on the test, you know?
Yeah,
I remember hearing that over and over again through high school and college. Self-esteem, defined internally, worthwhile, with and without approval, or even with disapproval. Knows I am not my behavior, although I am responsible for how I behave. So, as opposed to feels I am my behavior, and somebody else probably made me this way. You know, the victim mentality, right?
Yeah.
Better able to see the connection between behavior and its consequences, as opposed to difficulty seeing that connection. Better able to see choices and options and to make decisions, as opposed to having difficulty. Personal sense of empowerment and independence is common, as opposed to feelings of helplessness and teacher dependency, which are common in the schooling systems, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Operates from an internal value system, what is best or safest for him or her, while being considerate of the needs and values of others, as opposed to an external value system with significant others and carrots and sticks and all that. Thinks and may obey, as opposed to obeys and may think.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Has confidence in internal signals and in one's ability to act in one's own self-interest, as opposed to lacks confidence. And better able to predict outcomes or consequences of actions. Better able to understand and express personal needs. Better able to take care of one's own needs without hurting self or others. Well, that's a really important thing to learn. And unfortunately, as we've covered before, the needs vocabulary is not really focused on.
No, not at all.
In school, let alone anywhere else in society. So it's like we're kind of really hit and miss in terms of expressing our needs.
Yeah, and hurting,
understanding them.
Yeah, hurting others in an attempt to meet one's own needs is a big part of school, not just for students and cliques, but for teachers too.
Yeah. Yeah, looking at things as win-lose strategies, right?
Yeah.
Better developed negotiation skills. Orientation is you win, I win, as opposed to you win, I lose, or I win, you lose. Being cooperative rather than compliant. Commitment to the task, experiencing outcome of positive choosing, as opposed to oriented toward to avoid punishment, keeping teacher off my back.
Yeah.
Last two here. Better able to resolve conflict between internal and external needs, what I want versus what the teacher wants, less inclined to guilt or rebelliousness, as opposed to experiencing conflict between internal and external needs. What I want versus what teacher wants may experience guilt and rebelliousness. And obviously, what the teacher wants is irrelevant in authentic learning.
Right.
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 As a basis, essentially, because when a teacher is in a role of dictating to a student or influencing them in some way, it's not that intrinsic motivation nurturing that's happening there.
No. No.
And so we need to let go of the control in that role that inhibits intrinsic motivation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And basically to be that guide on the side rather than the sage on the stage. I think that was John Holt's phrase, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, be a facilitator rather than an evaluator. I think that's really important. Although we are always evaluating and really astute tutors, you know, have this really useful relationship with the learner in terms of feedback and what they say and don't say to help the person excel and make new integrations, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's that sort of tenderness and care and concern about that intrinsic motivation process to find the answer or to ask the question, you know?
And it's so much easier for that to happen outside of the school environment.
Oh, yeah.
I remember saying in like one of the first shows, reflecting on my experience as a tutor, whenever we were having like a really great connection or breakthrough, it always seemed to happen when we had clearly gone off the rails for whatever we were supposed to be doing as far as the school's or the parents' orders,
mm-hmm.
which was unfortunate.
Yeah, I'd say. And the last one, may make poor choices to experience personal consequences and to satisfy curiosity. Interesting. May make poor choices to experience personal consequences and to satisfy curiosity. So that we see that in toddlers, young children especially, right? They want to see what happens when they do this. What happens when you pull the dog's tail?
Right.
Or the cat's tail. That's probably even worse.
Oh, my goodness.
As opposed to make poor choices to avoid disapproval or abandonment.
Yeah.
To make my friends like me more, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So satisfying curiosity, I think that's one of the instances of this authentic learning process.
You know, kids were invisible. I was 17 in 1994. I had no voice. I had no outlet for so many things compared to today anyway. I had no YouTube to post to. I had no way to connect with people or share my ideas. So I think even as in touch as Brandon was with, you know, the needs of young people in the writing of this part of the book, all those rules are ready to be thrown away as soon as people are ready to throw them away. I mean, he was just writing from a different vantage point in history, right? And now we can look back at the last 20 years and we can see what has become possible. And we can see the silliness of these old rules and old strictures and old routines of school in a way that maybe he couldn't at the time, in a way that hardly anyone could at the time, except for people who were on the cutting edge of school reform or school rebellion.
You know, I read this book 20 years ago when it came out. I've got the hardcover edition in my hands right now. Mm-hmm. And I disagreed with him then, a couple decades ago, because I was an anarcho-capitalist, you know, I was voluntarist. I guess I couldn't be called voluntarist because I was still thinking that voting was in some way able to get us to a stateless society quicker in some way, you know, to educate and so forth. But nonetheless, when I had the idea of complete human liberation through anarchism, that lens helps you see the power over tactics that Brandon seems to miss here. You know, it helps you see the need for trust that is just so important to get met in our society if we're ever going to be in a free society.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know,
if we're going to have a free schooling system, and I don't even want to call it a schooling system, let's just call it learning environments, you know, whether it's, you know, on your own, not getting paid, just autodidactic stuff, or if it's in a collaborative group, making a project, you know, achieving some goal monetarily, some sort of business venture, all that stuff is just learning. And what we want is an orientation to ourselves to have trust in ourselves and trust in others, to be intrinsically motivated, to see needs and meet needs as they come up, as they become pressing for oneself.
This is Brett, and in case you haven't heard, I would like you to pay me $6 a month for doing School Sucks Podcast. Now, I know some of you are saying, Brett, no. But others might be asking, $6 a month? What are you going to do to earn it? All subscribers get access to a bonus content section called the AV Club. How about a little peek at what's inside? Drop the beat. Everybody knows. Role play.
I asked you a question.
Yeah, but why? Who are you? I don't understand what's happening.
Do you see this badge on my chest?
So you are airport security?
Sir, I work for the transportation security asshole.
That's not what it stands for.
Men's health issues.
If my brain wasn't evolved enough to handle as much porn as I watch, how would I be able to watch that much porn and not have exploded by now?
Well, very rarely will you see a man explode.
Experimental radio.
I'm Gardner Goldsmith along with Brett.
That's never been done before. Political science.
All a dog will ever make is poop, and all bureaucrats ever make when they're at work is government.
Regular science.
I have a disease that makes me turn into a bat.
Science fiction.
Now, I love Doctor Who, but his explanations are so cockamamie.
History.
Abraham Lincoln spent a lot of time around logs.
I learned that in school.
Yeah, he also had a giant blue ox named Bates.
And he freed the slaves.
Foreign affairs. The Russians.
Remember them?
Yeah.
Huh. They'll be back.
Friendships.
Okay, we are back.
Yeah! Fuck you.
Interviews.
What do you like to do? What are you calling for?
I like to carry home.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Me too.
Philosophers interviewing dead terrorists in heaven.
I have a question for Osama. So, according to certain interpretations of Islamic law, you get 72 virgins in heaven. What I don't understand is that in heaven, I don't think anybody ages. Like, you don't get older because you're never going to die. So nothing about your body changes. So isn't it the case that these women are going to stay virgins for the rest of time?
Osama hates that. Osama has 72 virgins, and they just keep telling me that they love me. They always text me, "I love you, Osama," and put a little smiley face at the end.
That's good to know. It's good to get that kind of feedback on what's going on in heaven there.
Presidential wisdom.
Three words. Transdimensional lizard Jews.
Snakes. On a plane.
Snakes on a plane! Aw, shit! Snakes on a plane!
You guys are great!
Liberals.
I really suggest you check out a book. It's written by Professor Richard Crabtree. It's called How I Know Everything About Why the Free Market Doesn't Work, Even Though I Never Spent 5 Minutes of My Career Outside of Academia. Volume 1.
And of course, the behind-the-scenes planning of some of our greatest moments.
I'm going to make him get up and face somebody and pretend like he's showing them his d***. And then that later that person gives him a job and they get married. It should be Kokesh.
This is going to be an absolute train wreck, dude.
So don't settle for some corny 4-minute ad that takes reputable people out of context in a comically misleading way, like this.
Do we want a giant mommy state or do we want a giant daddy state? Because what else is there?
Right. And this.
They demolish the buildings with lasers from the sky.
And this.
And we're going to make sure all businesses supply hardcore porn. You know what I mean?
No, instead, get in there. There's over 150 hours of additional content. And even if you don't have time to listen to it all, which nobody does, once in a while it's okay to go on a little internet treasure hunt. So go to schoolsucksproject.com and click on the support tab.
I'm Newt Gingrich, and I endorse this message.
Thank you for your participation.